Seattle. We're actually at the home of Naveen Jain, who's the founder and CEO of a company called Intellius here in Seattle. But more importantly, from the science of educating's perspective, we met at a discussion that was put on by the X Prize Foundation, discussing this whole notion of a prize for educating, the science of educating. Tell me about your role in XPRIZE, because you're chair of the global education project within that organization, right?
Yeah, so I recently joined XPRIZE for their education and global development. And, you know, really, if you think about some of the world's greatest challenges, I believe many of them can be solved through innovation, especially in the innovation in education. And I believe the whole idea of science of educating is so important, because we all know there is something is not working, and we all need to find out what is it that we need to do to get people to really not only focus on learning, but actually know when they are learning.
Now, I know you're very, I sense, you had a dinner here last night with a number of people who are all sort of experts in the fields of business or education or something like that. And there was palpable frustration in that room. And some of these magazines that I've shown people before, these magazine covers, are what the public generally sees about what they think the state of education is. How to Fix America's Schools, there's one. A recent Time cover, Should Schools Bribe Kids to Do Better? Question here, what makes a great teacher? Here's cover of Newsweek. The next, the key to saving American education, we must fire bad teachers, written here on the blackboard. Another one from the New York Times Magazine, building a better teacher. So it became, the debate came to be about the something wrong with the schools. Get rid of the bad teachers, or the school districts is wrong, school boards are wrong, there's something wrong in the schools. And as you know, our perspective within the Temple Dynamics of Learning Centers has been to say, well, instead of saying that, how about looking at some of these other publications, like this one by Terry Sanofsky and Pat Kuhl, Andy Meltzoff, Javier Mavean, Foundations for a New Science of Learning, published in the journal Science. How about we look in these things like the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, almost impenetrable titles, Adults with Dyslexia are Impaired on Categorizing Speech and Non-Speech Sound on the Basis of Temple Cues. How do you, there's a mass, my point is there's a mass of science out here.
Absolutely.
Which needs to find its way into the science of educating. And I think that that's a point where you have some sympathy with it.
Yes. So, you know, we can all try to have a hypothesis of why the education is not working. Is it really the teachers' union? Or do we really have C-class teachers who can't get a job and really teaching? It could be a number of reasons, but I believe it is, let's focus on the children. Why is it they're not learning? So one of the things that you and I discussed yesterday there, you know, first thing is the families really need to be involved in education. If you look at from a structural perspective, unless when they come home, the families really teach the children how important the education is. But let's put that aside. Let's focus more on the science of educating here. Today, we don't have to tell the children that they should go play video game. What is it about that video game that excites them? It is that, you know, from the time that we grew up and when we were in the elementary schools versus now, the media has become so rich that from the time they are born, their brains are being stimulated by moving images on the television. Very, very rich three-dimensional media on Xbox. Now they're playing with other children on social networks. They're playing on Xbox with other kids. But we are still teaching the kids the same old way that we learned 100 years ago. So when their minds are now being stimulated through very rich media, and the education is still being done in the old ways, their mind is not being stimulated in a way that it essentially is, I would say, is conducive to learning. So my theory is, why is it we can't make education as entertaining and as rewarding as a video game? And this theory has been tried in multiple times, and we find the kids who learn through these things, a rich media experience, not only learn better, they score better, and they actually understand the basic concept of that education.
We had somebody there last night, and he was making a similar point that you'd invited, about maybe maybe we should be concentrating more on simulating things. Yeah. And in a simulated environment, that becomes a learning environment. I mean, it was the general point, I think, that was being made. And I think that was something that appealed to you. I mean, I'm talking about Barney Pell
now.
Yeah.
So I think the idea is just not the simulation.
And he was mentioning that very popular game that's out there right now.
Yes. World of Warcraft.
Exactly, which is the number one search item on Google, apparently.
Yes. I mean,
this is just huge.
Yes. So the idea is not just about simulation. It is about providing the children the activities that they can engage in, they find entertaining, they find rewarding, and they find that it's in the personal scope, that essentially in a game, when you get something wrong and you fail, nobody else is watching. In some sense, it only gives you a challenge to go do it better. In the real world, when we go out and fail, we are told, oh my God, you are an absolute failure. In a game environment, that's not happening. So how do we create that environment where people can essentially learn at their own pace while even that they're playing and learning together? So how can we create an environment where people learn together, but they learn at their own pace? And sometimes people have to try different things. And in some sense, through the trial and error and the simulation and the rewards that come with that to move to the next level, or you have a new weapon now in your possession. And in fact, there was quite a bit of discussion that how one of the gentlemen was trying to teach kid about immunology and had a very difficult time, even though he was the most motivated teacher because he's a father. He really knew the subject. So it wasn't that the teacher was incompetent. It wasn't their motivation wasn't there because he was unionized and he just didn't want to teach. Here's a father who genuinely knew the subject, genuinely wanted teach to learn, to for kids to learn. Yeah. And even though the kid wasn't learning because it was the way it was being taught. And then he bought this video game about called Immune Attack and gave it to this child. And he learned more about immunology from that. So it tells you that it is not about the teachers need to be incented or they are bad teachers or they don't know the subject well. It is how kids learn and how their minds are being stimulated is not happening in today's education.
Now, the obviously, that just to play devil's advocate for a moment, and today's USA Today, big article that says here, attention spans get rewired. Are we adapting or losing our focus with always on technology? And this is a report about Nicholas Carr's new book, the one called The Shallows, mm-hmm. What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. Mm-hmm. And so, obviously, you know, as soon as you get Twitter, the Twitterverse going out there and all this sort of stuff going mm-hmm. on, people start saying, well, my children's brains are going rotten. They're not getting out in the real world. Mm-hmm. They're just immersed in this world of bits and bytes. What's going on? So there's obviously a dark side.
Well, in some sense, it is that any time there is a change happens, the people who are new to the change find that change to be evil. They find the change, they see the bad things, the dark things of that change. But the beauty of almost most changes are that people who live in the change not only adapt to the change, they actually find the complementary things that they need. So there are children who actually live in that world will not only be doing this Twitter and while there are things, then they would go out and actually spend a focused time with their friends and really doing things that are meaningful. So in a sense, there are going to be some kids who will never get out, and those kids will exist irrespective whether the internet existed or not. I'm sure, Roger, you can remember that in our days, there were children who never left the house. They were sitting in their own home and they were just socially awkward kids.
I do remember some people saying, I've asked this question before, saying that they remembered somebody coming up to them saying, put that book down and get out there and do something. See, when reading was the thing that the sin that was being committed.
Exactly. So the point is, I think, you know, in some sense, you know, it is a generational gap that we have today. You can argue that, you know, that today's children, you know, if you and I were sitting there and you were looking at your Craig Berry, and you would say, oh my God, Roger, this is so disrespectful. I'm talking to you. How can you be possibly?
I've got my iPad here. I'm sorry.
But you know what? When you look at the teenagers today, They could be talking, they could be chatting on a BlackBerry, and they would be taking a phone call. To them, it is just extremely natural, because that's how they grew up. So when you and I think that it is disrespectful, they think, what part of it is disrespectful? That's how we all act amongst ourselves, right? So even though there's attention deficit that we talk about it, they would call that a multitasking. And you say, it is us, the old people, who were lived in the world of MS-DOS, they still know the single tasking, one task at a time. And we are all living in the multitasking mode where we can do five things at a time.
Yeah, but this is a rather unusual household, let's be honest. I mean, your son Neil, how old's Neil?
13.
Right, so I happened to have my iPad, yeah. And I was complaining about the fact that I couldn't yet play Flash movies on here. And he said, well, that'll be solved as soon as you get HTML5 on there. He's 13?
Yes.
So he knows about how to solve my playing movies on an iPad. And then last night, your daughter Priyanka, yeah. Who is in 16. High school, gave this incredibly impassioned talk full of statistics about women's education globally, an organization she'd helped set up and so on. Your son, Ankur Jain,
yes.
Set up this Kairos Society, is hugely interconnected, working with entrepreneurs in terms of talking about education and so on as well. Not everybody can have this kind of family background, this kind of household. But so how do you get that kind of passion more into the whole educational field?
Well, I think it just comes from the family. I mean, obviously, I grew up extremely poor. So
you're from Uttar Pradesh?
From India. And, right. You know, there were times we didn't have food to eat. But we all in a family understood the cycle of poverty can only be broken through education. So, you know, some people come to me and say, well, obviously, if the parents are not educated, it's very difficult for them to create a role model for the children for the education. And I said, that cannot possibly be true, because my mother didn't even go to high school. But it didn't stop her. For every single day, she'll wake me up at 5:30 and say, we're going to do the homework and we're going to do this math book. She will make me sit down and say, tell me the answer to this problem. And I say, Mom, the answer is 7. And she say, don't make me look the answer. Why don't you recheck again and tell me what the real answer is? And I'll do it again and say, Mom, the answer is 7. Good. Why don't you go to the next problem? Mm-hmm. The little that I know, that she had no idea what the answer was. But point is, it was mother's love and her focus on education, because she knew the only way we're going to get out of the poverty is going to be through education. So our thing is that we as a family have to provide the value of education. And I believe that once the children know what is expected of them and what is important to the parents, you'll be surprised how many children would do that. Is when they come home and say, you know, forget the education, nobody needs that. If that's what they hear at home, it doesn't matter what teachers do at a school, they're not going to come home to learn.
One of the things that was mentioned last night was when I mentioned that cover of Time magazine, which talked about maybe we should bribe kids to do better. It's a serious program. It's not to be. I mentioned this to Esther Wojcicki,
yes.
Who has a Palo Alto High School teacher, and has built up an enormously. Enthusiastic class of kids there. It's a journalistic class,
and it's called Empowering the Children.
And that's what when I asked her about that, she said, "I wouldn't. The bribe, the reward they get, is that they're running this whole thing. They're empowered.
Yes,
it's theirs. They own it.
It's very interesting. It's not just the empowering. You could also argue: should you be bribing the parents? That means if you bribe the parents to say, you know what? We will, as opposed to saying we will give $1,000 a month extra to the teacher if the students' scores improve. What if you go out to the parents and say, we will give the parents $1,000 a month if the kids' scores improve? And think about that, how quickly they will find a way to educate their children.
So Peter Diamandis, of course, of the XPRIZE Foundation, I remember him saying that you get what you incentivize.
That's right.
So the trick is to figure out exactly what the result you want is, and rather than just limping along and being constantly beset by bad surprises.
Well, in some sense, that is where, you know, it's non-science thing. we as a society don't know what is that education means. And also we as a society believe that all child have equal capability. So in some sense, we are told that every child, that a child who is at high school cannot read or write. But we as a society tell the child, you are a very bright young man. You can be a president, you can be a scientist if you wanted to. Why don't we go out and not have this fear that everybody has to get a four-year degree and everybody has to be a scientist? Why can't we incent those kids and say, you know what, the society needs everything. You can get a two-year vocational training, maybe you become a great auto mechanic, maybe you can become a great electrician. There's nothing wrong with those jobs, as opposed to setting these kids as a failure. You did not go to the four-year college and you are a failure. To say, you know what, you went to the two-year and you are the best auto mechanic that this country will ever have. So in some sense, the idea is, what is it that is a society we expect? So you can incentivize once you know what to expect. And I think we as a society has not quite agreed upon what is the value of education. What is it that we want these kids to be when they grow up?
Yes, what's the value of a human being?
Yeah.
In this article in the USA Today, there was a comment there by Mike Merznick, who's a very well-known researcher at UC San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And Mike was saying, and has studied this whole notion of neuroplasticity, the ability of brains to change, make new circuits, adapt. And he was saying, much as you did, kids are going to look at these things anyway. They're going to, but they it's nevertheless a good idea that they should nevertheless be encouraged to get away from those screens as well and go and do something, go for a walk. The statistics that show how little movement and activity kids get is kind of startling, and it's compounded by the fact that when local school districts have budget problems. Mm-hmm. They do things like cut PE lessons or cut music lessons. And you and I have spoken about this. Yes. You know that those things, scientists have shown quite clearly what your grandmother would have told you, that you need movement. Yes. The movement is helping with parts of the brain, hippocampus, dentate gyrus. Music is great for learning synchrony, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. So these things are immensely powerful to optimize the information processor that every kid has, no matter where they are on the globe. There's the injection of neuroscientifically validated information seems to me to be, at least to us, to be the key to this.
I agree with you, but I think the point is somehow we believe that education is done at a school. And that is the fundamental difference. We say if it's not being taught at a school, that means it's not being taught. Mm-hmm. That means somehow we have believed the value of the family and the education of the family. We need to make the family and the school complementary and really complement each other. So when the school, they teach about the things because they don't have a budget to talk about the playing soccer or things. That's what the parents need to become a partner for the school and say, you know what? When you come back from a school, we're going to spend an hour playing outside. So why is it that parents can't go spend a time and spend an hour with the family to play with that? The parents can encourage the child to essentially pick up a hobby in the music and really teach that. It doesn't really need to be, I don't know piano, but our kids learn it by themselves. They'll pick up the book, they'll pick up the music sheets, and they will learn along the lines. In fact, some of the best musicians have never had a tutor. So, you know, it's not that it's the music is the learning. It could be very well self-taught learning. Yeah. So the point is, we somehow believe the education stops at school. But we, you know, education is a lifelong learning. Every single minute of the day, when we are alive, we are learning something.
And it is also the case that parents actually, the importance of parents is obviously brought home over and over again in these conversations I have with people. It's amazing as well how much they actually know, but not necessarily always implement. For example, I was talking last night to your wife, to Anu, and I was mentioning a conversation I'd had 2 days ago with a researcher at UC Berkeley, who actually works on sleep, Matthew Walker. And he thinks about the policy issues about this as well. And if you notice on our website, the sleep is very important.
Absolutely.
Because it's, and that's to do with education as well. What time do you?
Sure.
And Matt was pointing out that in fact people have got different. Obviously, children of different ages have different rhythms. And having them all start at the same school time at 7 o'clock makes
absolutely no sense.
Now, I was beginning to explain this to your wife, and she said, "Oh well," she said, "the youngsters need to go in first, and the teenagers need a couple of hours to even get up and start working." Yes. You know, but the practicalities of this are immensely difficult, aren't they? I mean, how do you have relays of people taking people in at different hours of the day and so on?
Well, that's the point. So in some sense, you have to start thinking and saying, you know what, are we focused on educating, or are we actually focused on making the life easier for parents, right? And in some sense, you could argue that, you know, in a family where the both parents have to work, there have to be a structure. But the point is, in some sense, you have to look at the stuff and saying teenagers are going to always sleep late. It is not in their control. This is how the growth happens. They're going to be awake until 12 o'clock or 1 o'clock. And if they have to wake up at 6, they're getting 5 hours sleep. You know it's hurting their growth of the brain, as we all have known. It hurts their growth physically. It hurts their growth emotionally. Yeah. So the fact is, we have to find a solution where schools have to say, you know what, maybe they can have the first 3 hours, but we are not going to teach them. They can go have a self-learning for 3 hours for the parents. You know what? And they can sleep at a school if that's where they need to be.
Now, why? So it's because of your own background that education has become such an important topic for you to work with. I mean, you actually have been in the software in worked with Microsoft for a period as well. You were originally qualified as an engineer. So the science. Especially, my sense has always been that India has a very strong scientific tradition, and lots of Indian students I see in this country and so on. So there's this great interaction going on all this time.
Yes and no. I mean, if you think about when you have 1.4 billion people, you'll always find 100 million people who will really be good at something. So if you only have a population of 400 million, 100 million is 25%. But if you think about it, the 10% of this country will have a great scientist, and that'll be 40 million. But when you have 1 billion people, that'll be 100 million. So in some sense, you know, it's a reverse discrimination. So when people look at somebody from India, they say, you know, the people from India are really, really smart. What they forget to see is, in India, even to get to a college, to go to the IIT, which is a good, I would say, engineering school, the 200,000 people apply to get for 2,000. So when people talk about and say, MIT is very difficult to get in, or the Harvard is difficult to get in, they take 10%. To get to IIT, they take 1%. And then you go to the graduate school, they take 1% of these kids, they're going to take another 1% of these kids who are going to go to graduate school. And then you decide you're going to go to the land of opportunity called America. And then they take 1% of those kids when they come here. So by the time they come to the United States, they are really in the 0.1% of the country. And you can look at any country, the 0.1% of that country are really, really good people.
So suppose, I mean, let's play a game. Suppose we one of the other things that came out last night was there was a lot of, some criticism of the way the current administration is going in terms of education. What would you do? It's obviously an enormously difficult job. Suppose I said, okay, you're now Arnie Duncan. You're the Secretary of Education. How would you go about it?
So actually, this is interesting you ask, because I keep thinking that, you know, is this really this administration? Because you go back and look at the previous administration, which was a different political party. What did they do? So it's the point is, it's not really a political issue. The issue is, how do you solve the problem? If I am the Secretary of Education or I am the president, I'm going to go out and set that challenge to say, look, if the kids learn through rich media, and let's assume there is no market for rich media because parents can't afford or buy, So what if I'm able to say, I'm going to give $100 million to a company that develops a curriculum that's based on the rich media that's able to improve the kids' score by 30%, as opposed to spending $100 billion trying to find a solution of the teachers' union and how to incent the teacher. Should we bribe the kids? Should we bribe the teacher? Should we bribe the parents? What if the kids learn through a certain mechanism and we know we have tested and proven to work? Why not make that available to all the children? And if, let's assume hypothetically, one thing we heard last night, Roger, was that they went and looked at a particular county and they took this rich media experience and found the kids to be extremely engaging and it really worked. They couldn't take it to the different county because the teacher said, you know what, something I don't understand, I don't want it. But one of the gentlemen, Duncan, actually said, you know what, let's go bottoms up. Let's take this stuff and give it to all the children. So if I'm the Secretary of Education, as opposed to worrying about how am I going to get this into the school, I'm going to just make it available to everybody for free and every student had access to it. Then you create a pull model. The kids are going to learn enough. Then they're going to go out to the teacher and say, can you explain to me about how, why this works this way? And the teacher themselves, out of their own self-respect, are going to go out and learn because the kids know more than they do. And in fact, that happens today if you think about it. Most families and most teachers, a 15-year-old kid or 13-year-old kid will tell the teacher how to turn that computer on, how does it really work, how to use this software program. So the point is the kids actually do learn in a certain way, and I think as long as we embrace, our generation has to say, you know what, these kids are going to be different and they're going to be better than us in certain ways, and we can actually become a complementary partner to learn from each other.
So what is it? I mean, you've had kids in this area in schools here. I mean, what's the experience been like? I mean,
wonderful, and in a sense that, you know, in each school you will find the certain things they do well. And again, as I said before, as a family we have to see how do we complement what is not being done well at that school. So there was a school our kids went to, a public school here, and we found their science curriculum was weak. We actually spent more time by buying them the science books for them to do the homework in the science that we felt was weak there. So in some sense, as long as parents are part of that education, rather than feeling that their duty is done the minute they drop the kid off to the school, and when they come back, the duty is done and they pick them up, that if they become part of the solution, I think we will solve the problem.
Yeah. So talk to me about your sense of science. One of the questions that I ask people, as you know, is about the role of science in society. Mm-hmm. And I refer back to President Obama's inaugural address when he came into office, and he said that his administration would restore science to its rightful place. Didn't say where that was. So I'm curious to know what you think the rightful place of science is.
Well, it is very obvious that innovation and entrepreneurship are the only way in a long term to solve world's greatest challenges. That means it's the inventors and the entrepreneurs who take risks are the only one who can provide a scalable long-term solution to almost all of the world's problems. So unless we can find not just the fundamental science, people who are willing to use the science and the innovation that's coming out of the academia and really building a solutions based on that. That means inventions are good, but we really need good inventors who are able to take these inventions and make them practical and make them worthwhile so they are useful to the humanity.
Okay, so central is your answer then, central to the whole enterprise.
I believe not only it is the center of the universe. I mean, without the science, we cannot grow. I mean, the science is the core, the fundamental, the foundation, and it is the center of the universe.
Did you ever, as you were growing up or as you've gone along, have you ever thought about, is there anything else you would have liked to have done? I mean, I noticed Neil down there. I see a drum kit was around there. So he's obviously deeply interested in music and so on.
In all honesty, in a life, you never look back and say what could have been, should have been, would have been, right? It is all about moving forward and saying, what is it I could do, should do, would do, as opposed to could have been, should have been, would have been. Yeah. So I have never in life said, you know, I wish I did this. I always say, I wish I get a chance to do this.
Okay. What do you want to do next? What are you optimistic about achieving? What are you concerned about?
Well, you know, in some sense, I turned 50 last year, and that was a big break from at least from my perspective of life. I felt in the second phase of my life, I really want to focus on finding ways of making a difference. I want to go find how can I, all the things that I've learned now that I've gotten gray hair, I want to go back and find a way, how can I take that learning and give it back to the society in a way where I can actually make a difference? And I'm going to go back on this soapbox again for a second here. One of the things that's wrong with our country here is we take the old people and somehow we make them outcast. And if you look at many other countries, say in China or in India, mm-hmm. the people with experience are respected. The elders are respected in the society. There is, you know, in our society in the United States, the elders, you don't know anything. I think we need to find your retirement home so you can die peacefully somewhere else. We have no use for you anywhere. Whereas that means all the learnings, all the experience that they have had, we're never able to provide a feedback loop to the current generation so we don't keep making the same mistakes again and again and again. So we really need to think of people like us who are getting older. Look, we have gone through this. We didn't get the gray hair sitting in the sun. We got this gray hair through all this experience. And as we know, almost every science requires a feedback loop. And I think we need to close that feedback loop in our society to use the elders and their experience to make sure that we continue making progress.
Well, with such a huge boomer generation, perhaps there'll be more people out there. There obviously are stories in the newspapers now of more people working on starting to do hang gliding at 83 and stuff like that and taking risks. So there does
but
seem
giving
to be
back
a,
is, Roger, I think
shift,
coming back and saying really giving back, and I really believe people, all of us are, the fact we are alive, the fact we are healthy, the fact we are here today talking to each other, we have tremendous responsibility to give back to the society. And I think each one of us should feel that obligation that any point of time in life, when we have something, it's at the back of that society that we need to give back to. And I think it is just not what I would say is a responsibility, it's our obligation to do so.
I'm curious. Did you grow up with a religious background as well?
I sure did. Yes.
And you have no trouble putting the science together with that. It's you're totally comfortable with that, right?
Well, I think you know in some sense the religion is.
I assume Hindu, right?
Yes. Actually, my last name is my religion, Jain. Right. So Jainism is my religion. But the point is, it is a faith and a science, and people always wonder, can faith and science stay together? Actually, they stick together very well because science can doubt and science can never find what is, in some sense, a lot of times, unless the problem is solved, there is always a doubt, is it true or not? In faith, you always know it is true. Mm-hmm. You don't have to ever worry about proving it, that is it really that right angle exists or not? You know it's always going to be there. So in some sense, my faith is more about spirituality. My faith is about doing your best and leaving the outcome to be, it will be what will be. And you call that a God, you can call it a supreme being. But the fact is, God only helps those who help themselves. You do your best and leave the outcome to God. All that says is, you control your own destiny. You got to do your best and it will be what will be. Worry about the things that you can control and don't worry about the things that you can't control. That means leave it to God.
Jainism, so that's a quite a demanding place to be, I would have thought. I mean, there's this.
In some sense, yes or no. One of the things that I'm not a religious person from a sense of religion as such, but spiritually, yes. I mean, I pray twice a day and I meditate twice a day. But in some sense, the religion is more about, as opposed to praying to the God. What I found very fascinating about at least the Jain religion is you pray to the qualities that you want to have. So you say, I pray to the people who are wise. I pray to the people who have patience. I pray to the people who have these qualities because you want those qualities to be inside you. So you're praying for qualities to the people who possess those qualities rather than a human being. Or you say, I pray to Roger.
Which would be a great idea, of course. But my little knowledge of Jainism is of a people who also go out of the way to avoid killing insects, killing any form of life,
And I think, you know, I wish as a society we adapt. That's, you know, in some sense, what the religion says is that don't hurt others. So, you know, in some sense, if you are able to go out and have that empathy to say, I'm not going to hurt other people's feelings, forget about killing them. I'm just going to be a good soul who's going to go out and try not to hurt other people. That's not a bad thing for the society, I would say.
Now, in terms of heroes growing up and so on, and as one of the questions I always ask people is that I offer them a time travel token and say, you can use that to bring anybody from the past to your dinner table or to your the event you had last night. Who would you like to have, anybody, and just to have a conversation with them, ask them some questions?
You know, I am always been fascinated by people who have made a difference and who actually have left their legacy behind. I would love to meet Albert Einstein. I mean, was he really thinking about what he said, or it just so happened that it turned out to be true? I mean, you know, in some sense, some of these geniuses, what drives them? I mean, I'm so fascinated by the people who invent things. What is it when they wake up in the morning? What goes through their mind? I'm not, you know, unlike, I think this is one of the other problems. I'm going to get back on the soapbox again. Today, I was at an education conference a couple of weeks ago called iEARN. It's an international education resource network. They have a project called HERO. And they have thousands of these kids, and they ask them, who is your hero? 99.9% people, their hero was some celebrity or some sports person. Mm-hmm. Not, think about that. Not 1% of the people would say their hero is a scientist or an inventor or an entrepreneur. That tells you what is it that we value in our society. That is a reflection of our society to say we value this, which is a celebrity, not we value the people who are smart. We value the people who invent. We value the people who go out and make a difference. Not at one person say, my hero is Madame Curie. My hero is Albert Einstein. And that's a great reflection on, I think we need to change that when to child and saying, you need to be fascinated by the people who are out there going, doing these things that have made your life better for you. Whether it is people who made the, think about somebody who invented antibiotics. Without that, where would we be? Think about all the vaccines. I mean, where would we be without that? Yeah. I mean, our life would, you know, and those are the heroes we should be really be asking our kids to be looking up to.
So what would your advice be to a young scientist then? You've worked in companies where you've hired scientists and so on.
So my advice to scientists would be go out what you do best. However, find a great entrepreneur who is able to find a great use for that science to actually make a difference in humanity. So don't just invent for the sake of invention. Don't just go out and do the discovery for the sake of discovery. Find how is it going to be applicable to the humanity and how am I going to be able to make a difference in somebody's life. And if this is something that can make a difference in somebody's life, find a way to do so.
Okay, so last question here. What are you optimistic about?
I believe we are at the cusp of fundamental changes that we will see in the next 10 to 15 years. The whole revolution around genetics is going to fundamentally change how we live. You know, we will be able to probably live a better life than any generation has ever lived. We'll be hopefully be able to find cures for most diseases that are have confounded the humanity. I'm really fascinated and optimistic about artificial intelligence, and I really believe there'll be a way for us to be able to use artificial intelligence to be able to provide access to, say, doctors in developing countries. There's no reason we cannot create an artificial intelligence database that's voice activated. So somebody in Africa or India to pick up a cell phone and say, doctor, I'm not feeling well, and it's be able to diagnose that problem. I'm fascinated how technology today the nanotechnology, be able to have a chip on the cell phone where you'll be able to get a blood test, wirelessly transmit the information, or your X-ray, your iPhone will have an X-ray to be able to send that information to the artificial intelligence database and to be able to diagnose all the problems. And that will fundamentally change the developing countries where they have no access to doctors. Even if you can build a hospital, how do you get doctors to be there? Mm-hmm. So I think if you start to think about how nanotechnology, how genetics, how the artificial intelligence, all of these things are fundamental change. In some sense, we have to start to look at life. For many, many generations, we have fought war over resources because our fundamental belief is there is a scarcity of resources. What if the science and the technology and the inventions are able to provide abundance of resources? What if we are able to take synthetic biology and able to create the fuel from it? Do we still need to fight the war in Iraq and Afghanistan? What if you're able to take the genetics and able to provide plenty of food to people? Would there still be poverty out there? Why are we spending all of these times when we know the science and, you'll be able to create more meat by taking the stem cell and creating just the muscle tissue. So there'll be factories and factories of people if they want to eat beef. They don't need to raise cattle anymore. And all the land that they use for cattle can now be used for human beings.
What about India? Think about your original homeland. What do you see on the horizon? What do you see happening with India?
I think, both India and China are obviously the fact that they have great education system. They're creating great scientists. They're creating a great economy. And in some sense, they themselves now become the marketplace of their own. It is predicted that in the next 10 to 20 years, China will have bigger middle class that's going to have a bigger, better lifestyle than all of the United States. That means they don't have to ever have to rely on U.S. as their market. They will have their own population, which may be only one third of the population, and will always say, but look at the average people earning in China. But they're going to have a middle class that's going to have a better lifestyle than America. And that really worries me. So we need to really go out and fix our education.
Why does it worry you?
It worries me because we have an opportunity. We have an opportunity to fix our education system, to create more scientists, to create more entrepreneurs, to use the science. Because today, the people believe the manufacturing will go to China. And it's based on a simple fact that they believe manufacturing is driven by muscle power. That means wherever you can find the cheapest muscles, the cheapest human labor, that's where the manufacturing will belong. Mm-hmm. What if we are able to create DNA bots or the nanobots? So using the biological bots, we are able to create manufacturing right in this country. We have an advantage because we have the technology, and they don't have advantage over muscle tissue, muscle power anymore. So the fact is, we have to use our science, our innovation, and the whole nature of entrepreneurship, which is what this country was built on. If you think about it, what made our country great? We were the innovators. We attracted the best and the brightest from all parts of the world, and we gave them the land of opportunity. We cannot take that away.
It's been great talking to you. Thanks very much, Naveen Jain.
Thank you.